And it's my distinct privilege and honor to tell you a little bit. And believe me, when you hear this, you're going to say, oh, that's a whole long list of stuff. She said it was a little bit. But let me tell you, it is only a little bit of what our distinguished speaker this morning has done in her life. But I'd like to tell you a little bit about Mandy Carter. Mandy identifies herself as a Southern African-American lesbian and a social justice activist with a 44-year movement history of social, racial, and lesbi-gay trans justice organizing since 1968. Presently, Ms. Carter is the national coordinator of the Bayard-Rustin 2012-2013 commemoration project of the National Black Justice Coalition, a two-year national organizing effort that is working to acknowledge, honor, and celebrate Black gay civil rights activist Bayard-Rustin. Raised in two orphanages and a foster home for her first 18 years in upstate New York, Ms. Carter attributes the influences of the Quaker-based American Friends Service Committee, the former Institute for the Study of Nonviolence, and the pacifist-based War Resisters League for her sustained multiracial, multi-issue organizing. But it was specifically her participation in the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. inspired 1968 Poor People's Campaign, organized by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, that solidified her lifetime commitment to nonviolence. Ms. Carter helped to co-found two groundbreaking organizations. One is Southerners on New Ground, also known as SONG, and also the National Black Justice Coalition, the NBJC. SONG, founded in 1993, is about building progressive movement across the South by developing models of organizing that connect race, class, culture, gender, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Specifically, SONG integrates work against homophobia into freedom struggles in the South. She served as its Durham, North Carolina-based executive director from 2003 to 2005. NBJC, founded in 2003, is a national civil rights organization dedicated to empowering Black, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. NBJC's mission is to end racism and homophobia. Most recently, Ms. Carter was inducted into the National Federation of Black Pride's Black LGBT Hall of Fame during the January 2012 Martin Luther King holiday. Established in 2011, the IFBP Black LGBT Hall of Fame's mission is to recognize the achievements of Black LGBT men and women and their contributions to the development of the LGBT community and African American community as a whole. Ms. Carter received the Frank Porter Graham Award of the American Civil Liberties Union of North Carolina at its 42nd award ceremony in 2011. The award is given annually to recognize North Carolina's exemplary civil rights leaders. Ms. Carter was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize as part of the 1,000 Women for the Nobel Peace Prize 2005. In order to recognize, make visible, and celebrate the impressive and valuable, yet often invisible peace work of thousands of women around the world. Ms. Carter was one of the five national co-chairs of Obama LGBT Pride, the LGBT grassroots infrastructure for Barack Obama's historic 2008 presidential campaign. She has done the hard work of organizing grassroots networks, especially with people of color throughout the South. And today, we are honored by her presence, and we welcome her as she shares her lecture with us this morning. Mandy Carter, welcome to this place and this space. We look forward to learning from you today. Thank you.
Gee, who is this person?
Well, I must say, am I doing good, guys? Okay, guys back there telling me about, hey, Mary, you were just here yesterday, weren't you? Hey. Well, good morning. I told David that I'd rather really kind of have more of a conversation with you because I'm still figuring out what the heck happened on November 6th. But also, I'm also thinking long-term about where we have been, when I use the term we, and where we are going, and trying to make sure that as I'm on my journey and every one of you are on your respective journeys, how we have a way to have a conversation, do some exploring, scratching our heads, and then figuring out whatever that thing was that came together on November 6th to reelect our first black president against a backdrop of a legacy that's not so great. It's amazing. And so I want to just read my notes so I don't go off script. But also I want to leave a little time so that we might have a little chance just to hear some questions or comments or conversation as we move forward. Because I think if ever there was a time for all of us to be engaged in not only what we do every day when we get up, but also each one of our individual journeys. Like, even though I was raised in two orphanages in a foster home, why am I standing here before you in this particular place at this particular time? And if we don't take the time to ask every one of us who we know in our journeys, take the time to find that out, it can make a huge difference. So let me look at my notes and we'll get this. I'm excited to be here, literally. You need to know that when I first got contacted, until I literally arrived here at 12:09 in the morning when Thomas picked me up at the Amtrak station, all I had were email addresses and maybe a phone call with David and Kathy and April, because Harry Knox is our common bond, right, David? That's how I'm here. There was some kind of conversation about LGBT week coming up and wanted to connect the LGBT and faith-based organizing, and then another good friend of mine, Cedric Harmon, got involved, and emails and whatever, and then date got set. And all of a sudden, I think it was April who said, why don't you take Amtrak? Well, I do a lot of public speaking, and I fly everywhere, and I thought, Amtrak? At first, it's like, isn't that kind of a long ride? And then I thought, well, there's an Amtrak station in Durham. I could walk to it. And there's an Amtrak station in Lancaster. I'm sorry, probably saying that wrong. I've been corrected too many times. I'm going to go to LTS. It was great. Wi-Fi, cafe car, the countryside goes by, and I'm saying, I'm going to start rethinking how I'm going to do my travel in the future. I love Amtrak. And then, and the fact that, and by the way, Thomas, I know you picked me up at 12:09 in the morning. We have a 5:30 a.m. Train tomorrow. He'll be doing that for me, too. But there are some other thank yous real quick. Susan, we're Susan. We just did F&M. We just did Brother Outsider, the film about Bayard over at F&M across the street. I want to thank the folks who have been feeding me really well, Guy and John and Tom, and I'm having lunch and dinner with some other folks that are here. I already mentioned Thomas. And Guy and I had a little late-night snack last night because we got done with the film and we were eating lasagna and whatever and did some more conversation. But I have to tell you, oftentimes when you do movement organizing, it's not when you're doing something like this, it's when you're eating a meal, having some fun. That actually is when you get more stuff done. I do want to send you greetings on behalf of the National Black Justice Coalition. One of the things that I'm struck by is this whole notion of how does change happen? One of the ways change happens because someone makes a comment like this. You know what we need? Or what would we do if we were to do fill in the blank? Don't mourn, organize. If there's a need, fill it. Don't mourn, organize. If there's a need, fill it. And when you think about all the organizations and groups and, you know, there never used to be women's studies, black studies. That never happened when you think about, you know, on the campus life. But when you think about that, and if that's kind of how you start to make change against what you perceive to be just how status quo is or just how things are always done, well, one of the biggest needs we had was that for the African-American, lesbian, gay, trans community, for those of us who are in a position to be very out, very visible, was critical. I have nothing to lose about being out who I am, and as many other people do. So in a way, we get to be the face for those who cannot be seen. We get to be the voice for those who cannot be heard. Because I'm not going to put any judgment on anyone about one's coming out process. And this happens in all communities, but specifically thinking of the African American community. So when we decided to just form this thing called the National Black Justice Coalition, we also wanted to partner with our traditional civil rights organizations. Because it wasn't just about the LGBT. And by the way, that word LGBT, Mary, I was thinking you yesterday, last night, when I said to you, when you mentioned the LGBT, AA, queer, whatever, it's all regional. And I have to ask, when I go out now, I don't try to tell people you're this or that. I ask a very simple question. How do you self-identify? Do me a favor. But then you get to say how you self-identify from where you come from. And out in East Bay, California, they don't use LGBT. They say same gender loving. I love that. You know, so if you ask the question, and quite frankly, there's been places as an African-American lesbian, when I'm talking down south, they don't want to hear that word queer. They don't, you know, and so I'll ask that. You know, so you just try to be a bit more receptive or keep tuned to what the local stuff is, because you just can't make these broad sweeping things around that. But I do know that within our community, we use all those words and then more. But speaking of working with our civil rights organizations, I think a lot of people make the assumption times that if you're talking about the black community or the black church, we're very homophobic. Homophobia is homophobia. You're going to find it everywhere, y'all, right? But I must say that one of the things that the black, and another reason why MBJC plays a powerful role, there are some civil rights organizations that were looking for a partner in terms of their journey of how they were going to deal with this issue. It took the NAACP 100 years to finally form an LGBT task force, and they formed it with the National Black Justice Code. 100 years. And that journey for the NAACP, had it not been for people like Julian Bond and Alice Huffman of the NAACP California chapter, they got a huge amount of grief for stepping out and doing that. But how long do you wait? And it took them 100 years. Understand that in 2009, they took a lot of hits. But just to show you how time goes by the time we went to their national convention in Houston this past year, it was like, well, what was the big deal? But you see what I'm saying? That if you figure out what journey you have to be on in your respective communities, especially the traditional civil rights organizations, but it also helped to have Ben Jealous, who's the president, current president. He has gay people in his family. He understands what that's about. And what I'm really struck by historically, and why I'm still wrapping my mind around this thing that happened on November 6th, let's take a little journey back about this country, which is not that old. Here are some demographics that we need to keep in mind as we're looking forward. By 2050, this country will be a majority people of color. California already is by 2050. Right now, numerically, women are the majority, numerically. And the other one I'll throw in there is this interesting demographic of those of us born between the years of 1946 and 1955. If anyone feels comfortable, could you raise your hand if you were born between 1946 and 1955? Okay. There's 79 million of us. That's the post-World War II baby boomers. Just a little too young for the civil rights movement, but smack dab in the middle of that whole Vietnam War, feminism, and name me that whole litany. And I only mention that not because we're anything special, but we came with an interesting set of circumstances that I think defined an entire generation that is probably more consistent about staying actively involved in this whole issue of social justice and equal rights organizing has a bunch of folk interested in doing intergenerational stuff as well. Because that 1946 to 1955, just a little quick little history lesson, that's when I was born in 1948. The Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Last rights on the radio in Albany, New York, because it was a fear that that missile was going to come to New York City and wipe all of us out. The Cuban Missile Crisis. Think about that. This is the same time when they had air raid drills, duck and cover, run home. This is the time when they were having people building bomb shelters in their backyard. And to be living in that time with such an air of uncertainty, I wanted to be a doctor. I might not live long enough. I mean, I'm not kidding. That was a real sense of just, it was just tenuous. Then you add in 1963. All of a sudden, now I'm living in Schenectady, New York, upstate New York, but we knew what was happening down south. 63, 64, 65, the civil rights movement in the heyday of what was going on. And someone from the American Friends Service Committee came to our social studies class and talked about the Quakers and the Friends and the long history of equality and justice. And three things said that day to me, and I think to actually a whole generation of us, is why I'm standing here before y'all right now. I was, what, 16, junior in high school? This is a staff member. He said three things. The first one was this. The Quakers really believe in this concept of the power of one, that each and every single one of us has the potential to impact change if we so choose to act on it. And I didn't get it then, I sure do now, but the power of one, that each and every single one of us has the potential to impact change if we so choose to act on it, whatever those gifts might be that we have. That was powerful stuff to hear. Then he talked about this concept of about equality and justice for all, that if that is your sort of underlying of your philosophy, what you believe in, that you wake up every day with that is sort of like your grounding. Equality and justice for all keeps you current, keeps you relevant, keeps you really a lot intersectional. Didn't quite get it then either, but I remember hearing those words, but it was the third thing he said that really made the difference. By the way, we have a one-week AFSC high school work camp in the Pocono Mountains. Who wants to go? Why? Because it's one thing to walk around with all of these things swirling around. It was just one of the most profound. That was a 40-minute class. But I got to go to this one-week high school work camp in the Pocono Mountains. And we picked the food that we had to eat that day. But every day they would bring in resource people. And there was a young folk singing couple, white folk singing couple, that came up from down south because the way they wanted to figure out how they were going to have their contribution as a white ally to that civil rights movement was as folk singers, they were collecting songs of the civil rights movement and recording them. Their names were Guy and Candy Carowin from the Highlander Center in Tennessee. I have never been so profoundly impacted by two people. The Highlander Center, the reason why you should recognize that name because you have to think about Rosa Parks. Does everyone know who Rosa Parks is? Right, Montgomery bus boycott. Where do you think she went and did the trainings and the strategizing? Was it the Highlander Center? A member of the NAACP. Most people think she just woke up that day and said, I ain't going to the, no. I mean, it's nice to think about that because people think, well, if she can do that, I can do that too. But that's the background. The Highlander Center got burned to the ground because, folks, we ain't going to have no black and white folk having no nothing happening here in Tennessee. Got burned to the ground. But it's still there. It's out in Newmarket. Do yourself a favor. But you see what I'm saying? And because all of a sudden I was given the tools and the ideas and we were reading about Gandhi and nonviolence and nonviolent philosophy and politics. And the first time I heard about this guy named Bayard Rustin, I'm also coming out at the same time. We didn't have no LG. It was just called homosexual at that time. I'm coming out. And as I'm coming out, I'm thinking, well, who are my role models? I didn't have no black folk. I didn't know nothing. Joan Baez was bisexual and Janis Joplin was, whatever. But not to know about him, and we just did the film. What was the thing we heard most, Susan? Bayard who? Do yourself a favor. See the film, you've got it, but Google it, Bayard who, when we talk about how relevant. So to make a long story short, that changed my life completely. And then on August 28th, 1963, I was too young to be at that march. I'm just curious if there's anyone in this town or this campus that might have been there August 28th, 1963. We need to find that out. And or, David, we said, did Bayard come here? Just curious to do some work. But no one had any idea on that day, a hot sweltering on a weekday, 250,000 people. King gives his famous iconic I Have a Dream speech. No one knows how it happened, whatever. And then you move on. And then within 2 weeks, in Birmingham, Alabama, a Klan bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. 4 young girls lost their life that day. And prior to that bombing with the Klan, still in 1963, then Governor George Wallace had done 2 things down in the state of Alabama. He stood in the doorway of the University of Alabama, Tuscaloosa, when they were going to integrate that campus and said, ain't no black folk coming on this campus, but we know that did happen. But earlier before the Birmingham bombings, he had made a comment to a local reporter and said something to the effect of, and the way we're going to deal with stopping integration in the state of Alabama, all we need is a few first-class funerals. You got them. All we need is a few first-class funerals. Medgar Evers was assassinated. Then November 22nd, 1963, that will be etched in our memories for as long as we live, Kennedy was assassinated down in Dallas, Texas. You see what I'm saying about how this shaped an entire generation? And I said, you can't kill the president. I mean, it's not possible. Does anyone remember where they were November 22nd, 1963? And all that followed. Then you had 64 and 65. I say this against the backdrop of yet, given all that, and then getting back to this other point about the demographic shift, who was already here indigenous to these lands before any ships pulled up to these shores? Who was already here? Indigenous people of color. How were they treated then? How are we treated now? What is that? And some ships came because they wanted to be here, all about freedom and liberty and setting up, you know, name me this, that, and the other. But there were another set of ships came up from Africa. We're not indigenous to these lands. It's called the slave trade. 1600s, landing in Virginia, the heart of the Confederacy because of tobacco, free labor. Then when the cotton gin was discovered and formed, then all of a sudden, that's why cotton, free labor. An estimated 18 million African-American men, women, and children. And the thing that gets me, and I'm going to cry on this, how many never made it here on those ships? For centuries, several. And the bones of our ancestors are strewn between South America, Central America, North America, literally thrown away. And yet, in the selling and the auction blocks, and you name me what was going on with the slave trade in this country. And yet, I am astounded that despite all of that happening, and understanding that at some point in some time, things started to change, but they happened to change to women too, because when all those founding fathers were writing up the Declaration of Independence, when they talked about we the people, there's a great quote by Representative Barbara Jordan, one of the first members of the Congressional Black Caucus. And she talked about this concept, because who else had to deal with the issue of, but not you, on the issue of gender, who were already here, women. Women based on gender were told, but not you, in the areas of you didn't have a right to vote, you could not run for public office, you could not serve in the military, and good luck finding a job and marriage equality. I mean, let's be real. Then when black folk finally got the right to be full citizens, and it took them a couple of tries through the U.S. Supreme Court, what were we told? You didn't have a right to vote, you couldn't run for public office, you couldn't serve in the military, and you couldn't have access to a job. Sound familiar to you? That's exactly what was said to women based on gender. If ever there was an understanding about our common journey, if you will, women and people of color, think about that. What was the coalition that just got done electing this man for another 4 years? And in 2008 gave us Hillary Rodham Clinton, gave us Barbara Jordan, gave us where we had more women in the diversity of what we call everyone should be called included. Barbara Jordan made this great quote, if I can find it, here it is. This is what she said, we the people. It is a very eloquent beginning. But when that document was completed on the 17th of September in 1787, I was not included in We the People. I felt somehow for many years that George Washington and Alexander Hamilton just left me out by mistake. But through the process of amendment, interpretation, and court decision, I have finally been included in We the People. How does change happen? Change in hearts and minds, you know? If only people get to know who we are. We have parades, we have marches, we have all the wonderful things that we have to do to have people be engaged about who we are as human beings. But then it's also the changing of public policy. And when you get those two things combined, sometimes one coming before the other. Classic example, young black NAACP lawyer named Thurgood Marshall down south saying why people, black folks, should have access to an equal opportunity. Took it to the courts, one. Do you think people woke up the next day and said, what were we thinking? Of course they should have access to education. No, just the opposite. That was a major win. The reason why we no longer have Jim Crow laws on the books is because a young black woman named Irene Morgan from Virginia, once again, NAACP took it to the court, she won, and ended Jim Crow laws on buses. Thank you, Irene Morgan. Do you think people woke up the next day and said, what were we thinking? Of course. No. But the one that probably was the most impactful was when they decided once and for all, they took it to the U.S. Supreme Court to end the ban on interracial marriage in this country. I graduated high school in 1966. That didn't get decided until June 1967. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but if I knew the case that was going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court that would give one of the most important historic landmark decisions in this country about ending the ban on interracial marriage, and it was called Loving versus the State of Virginia, y'all won. Loving versus State of Virginia, because it was named after Richard Loving, a white man, married to Mildred Jeter, a black woman. Do you think people woke up the next day and said, well, of course not. Think about that. And black men were being lynched for even looking at a white woman, let alone marrying. I mean, the price that we have paid about this issue of marriage equality for women and people of color in this country, it's been a high price. And with all due respect, and I said this at dinner yesterday, we just won majorly big in Maryland and Maine and Washington for marriage. Don't call it gay marriage, please, and hear why. Here's why. If you call it marriage equality, you are recognizing and respecting those who came before us for why we have this win now. Women and people of color, because of the journey we have taken. And I say that with all due respect because I've heard some people say, well, we're the ones who really got this for all of us. No, you did not. You did not. And you didn't get it because of the military, because women and people of color were told not you in the military, and now we have Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We just got done doing that. Please remember those who came before you. The Employment Non-Discrimination Act, please remember who came before you. Because the very successes that we have now, and it's not a question of if, it's when, including the state of North Carolina, y'all. So I just want to make sure our community and our movement understands that. Please, marriage equality, and I'll tell you how else it plays out, is because one of the reasons why the NAACP, who historically, in addition to just getting on with the LGBT stuff, it was Reverend William Barber of the North Carolina NAACP who this past May said, because we had one of these anti-marriage ballot initiatives, said, I think it's time for us to stand up and say that we have got to talk about this as a civil rights issue. And defined it as a civil rights issue based on marriage equality. And when he took that down to the National Council of the members down in Miami, Florida, of the National NAACP, they said, Jess, I think you're right, we need to do that too, and we saw what happened with Obama. You see what I'm saying? All these journeys that have happened. But to keep it in a proper context, I think it's very, very important not to get ahead of ourselves and figure out, and when we're talking about LGBT Pride Month, or week, or month, whatever, I think it's important. And also, how many of us are sitting here in multiple identities? I do a lot of public speaking. I get invited to colleges. In one college in North Carolina, I get invited 5 times from the same campus. January, King holiday. February, Black History Month. March, Women's History Month. June, LGBT Pride Month. October, National Coming Out Day. And while I don't mind getting that honorarium, I did say, have you ever thought of inviting me when you all come together, because I would like to bring all of who I am to this campus? You know what I got back? Sorry, Mandy, but the Black Student Union doesn't get along with the LGBT student group, and sorry, Mandy, but the way, and I'm thinking, what? And you're on a campus, and you're sitting at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill? What? And that award called the Frank Porter Graham Award is named after Frank Porter Graham, who was the head schmo there when the Journey of Reconciliation buses came through in 1947, the first Freedom Rides, when it was a segregated campus. He had the first Black opera singer perform at UNC Chapel Hill, invited the bus riders, including Bayard Rustin, to go onto that campus in 1947 and talk about this issue of integration on college campuses. And here we are in 2012, and I have five different groups invite me to come, five, because they're not, come on. And then I thought maybe part of the problem is because we're not being intentional about how we go about the business of the issue of equality and justice, whether it's on a college campus, whether it's a seminary, whether it's in the community, name me whatever the scenario is. If we're not being intentional, seriously, how does that happen? And then I pose this question to all of us. How many of us have ever intentionally, by design, went to some place in which you were the only one? I'll repeat what I just asked. How many people have ever intentionally gone someplace where you were the only one, however you define that, whether it's around ability, whether it's around color, whether it's around race, whether it's around gender? And I call it the Rolodex complex. We all have our Rolodexes. You have one. Thomas, you have one. And what we tend to do is we have the Rolodex cards of everyone we know. I got my buds. I got my peeps. But do you have in there the people you need to know, or the people you really want to have some serious conversation with about equality and justice issues, name me whatever the thing. But if they're not in there, we're at a loss. So it's not only putting the cards in there of who we need to be having these wonderful coalition and conversations with, it's also about getting off of our table. If I had a dollar for every time I've heard this comment, and other folks I'm sure can relate, well, how can we get more people of color to our meeting? And if they come, how do we get them to stay? Do you know what folk of color are saying at their meeting? How come we have none of our white allies at this meeting? And they've given up asking. They're not expecting it. Don't expect it. And then when someone does finally show up, the first thing they're going to get is, why are you here? What you doing here? That's the first thing. But when that person comes back the second, third, fourth, 10, 15th time, then it's like, now I know you're being serious. But why does it take that to happen? Then I'm thinking, I'm looking at this room. There's probably a lot of bridge builders in this room who feel comfortable. I'm fine, I'll go. You know? But has anyone invited me? Did anyone ask me? We make a lot of assumptions, don't we? And here's one that I think is a really wonderful gift that I think is really underutilized. Now, if I were to say to you, Thomas, I just met you 1209, two, whatever days ago it was, and you didn't know me, and, you know, I hugged you, didn't I, when I got off? I'm a hugger. I love hugging. But if I asked you at that moment, Thomas, we have some big thing, and I want you to be engaged, and you'd say, well, who are you? And, you know, but if it's a friend of yours who says, I want you to do it because you asked me. See what I'm saying? Because, David, because you asked me, someone you know, there might be something they're not even sure they want to be involved in. They might be skeptical, but there's this little gift of, but I'm willing to take a chance because you asked me. Do we ever utilize that? Or within our social or academic naming, because you asked me, because there's a little bit of a trust factor that goes into. So you step out of what you perceive to be your safety, whatever that goes on. So I'm just throwing these things out, thinking as we move ahead how these things might be possible in terms of how we go. A couple of more points to make. Excuse me. Where's my clock? All right. Bear with me. Already did that. I don't know who does lectures, but if it wasn't for highlighters, highlighters, I don't know how I would get by. Hearts and Minds, yeah, did that. All right, so here's the question I think we have when I say we. Oh, where'd that water that someone gave me? April. So I think this question I'm going to ask before we move into just opening it up is this. This question, I think, is a combination of a challenge and an opportunity. Thinking of our LGBT movement, LGBTA allies, whatever. And thinking again about what was that unique, amazing, probably not by design, thing that just happened in November 6, 2012, knowing it wasn't that specific date, but all of the things that led up to that, given the long history of this very short history of this country. The question I have for us is, are we about justice, or are we about just us? Because it's no longer a question of if, it's when. When we now can get married, when you can now serve openly in the military service, and we have got to pass the Employment Non-Discrimination Act when we have access to a job, I have heard personally people say to me, I'm good, I got mine, I'm out of here. No. No. People did not spend their lives, literally, and all the work that had to be done to truly have a justice society so that someone says, I've got mine, I'm good. But then I wanted to dig deeper and find out why would someone say that. And then I did a little digging, and this was what happened. When SONG first got started, as you had mentioned, Kathy, we wanted to make sure that the work we did wasn't just about LGBT. One of the first projects we got involved with the farm workers out in Mount Olive, North Carolina. We wanted to work with the farm workers out in Mount Olive, North Carolina, because they had horrible working conditions, horrible living conditions, horrible pay, because they're just farm workers picking cucumbers, which makes what? Pickles. So when the Farm Labor Organizing Committee came to the state of North Carolina looking for allies to be involved in this, one of the first hands to go up was Southerners on the Ground. Because I said, if ever I could find a whole set of folk that we could bring to the table because they understand about inequality and justice, it would be our LGBT community. I was real excited. We have a big one in North Carolina, especially in the Triangle area. So I started making some calls, and this is the first call I made to a lesbian friend of mine. Pickles? What do pickles have to do with my lesbian rights, Mandy? No, I'm not interested. And when you want to get, if you want to call me back with something to do with my lesbian rights, let me know. I was devastated. I couldn't believe it. What? And then I really thought about something. Because for her, when she got involved in the lesbian movement, that's what they told her, that's what equality and justice is defined, only around being a lesbian. A lot of the national organizations were saying that. And that was how she defined herself. That's the door she came through. The door I came through was the whole anti-Vietnam, civil rights, broader door, so my vision, my understanding of equality and justice was much broader. So in a way, she was just reflecting what she had been told and heard. You see how important it is when you define equality and justice, you have to do it in much broader terms. But then I remembered something else. Has anyone ever been to a San Francisco LGBT pride parade? It's now up to 1.3 million every June. 1.3 million every June. It didn't start out that way. It started out with a bunch of drag queens from Polk Street going to City Hall and wanting to know what they were going to do for the rights of people in San Francisco. It didn't start out big. It was a tiny little thing. And when I was living and organizing in San Francisco, I remember on this one particular day, there were rainbow flags as far as the eye could see. And then all of a sudden, there was this contingent of black and red flags of the United Farm Workers of California. Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta were in that pride parade. And I thought, oh. And I heard someone next to me say, well, what are the farm workers doing here? That was an aha moment. because they understood about equality and justice. They came to LGBT pride, have been solidly behind this idea of equality and justice for all. So that being said, I think this question, are we about justice or are we about just us? And I've heard that same thing. Oh, immigration's not a gay issue. Or I don't know why we're talking about environment. That's not a gay issue. Or the death penalty's not a gay issue. And who's making these edicts? Who says? Who's saying this stuff? And do you see how important it is for the roles that we have if we go out here talking about this in much broader terms? And you cannot. David and I had breakfast today, and we were talking about you cannot ever forget the importance of faith-based organizing in these justice movements. Pivotal. Civil rights movement. And death penalty movements. Farm worker labor. All that is so, it's there. And in our community, I have people coming out twice. Remember I said this to you, Tom and John, when I said, you come out as gay, and then you have to come out as a person of faith. And everyone, you know, what is that? Come on. So we have some work to do, some good work, and I'm excited that we all get to maybe do it as we move forward. I think it's great. So I want to end with a quote from Coretta Scott King, and then, oh, wait a minute, what time is it? Oh, we have 10, 15, oh, Guy, you need a little thing up here to keep me from hunting this, a little thing. And I like to use my hands a lot, if you figure. So one of the interesting things I want to say, and please, if you can remember these dates, and I know you'll put it on the internet, on the email. This year is the 100th birthday of Bayard Rustin. Next year is the 50th anniversary of the August 28th, 1963 March on Washington. The King Center has already defined the dates of August 24th, which is a Saturday, which will be the day they'll do the big thing up at the Lincoln Memorial, to the 28th, between the Lincoln Memorial and the MLK Monument. And now that we know Obama's back for 4 more years, I'm sure that will be a big to-do with the White House and the administration. But we were thinking of creative ways in which we can engage this campus and in the campus next door, Susan. In Michael Long's book called I Must Resist, Bayard Rustin's Life and Letters, people have been creatively been taking these letters and been doing dramatic readings. They just did it at the University of Chicago. What would happen if between this campus, that campus, and the community, between now and August of 2013, you were to pull together some kind of theater thing, and Thomas, I've already put this bug in your ear as well, some kind of theater or something where you would do some dramatic readings of this. But also, Bayard did these powerful debates with Stokely Carmichael and Malcolm X around violence, nonviolence. We have the scripts, people can reenact that. So these would be two wonderful, besides lectures and all that, we talked about the idea, these would be two wonderful ways, dance, theater, spoken word, but some way not only to educate about Bayard, but also how culture has been also used in some way to move forward on how we go. And so in 2003, which was the last march that Coretta Scott King could make, and it was a historic one because they had asked the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and SONG to be part of the official co-conveners of the 40th anniversary of the march, how far we had come. And it was the last time she could be at that march. That was always part of who she was. And one of the questions that keeps on coming up is how do we find ways in which we can engage our communities of color, lesbian, gay, trans, disability rights organizing, women, labor, whatever. And then she always had people who came up to her and said, why are you talking about that gay thing, Mrs. King? What's up with that gay thing? That gay thing, she had a man named Lynn Cothran who was her personal secretary for more than 20 years who was a gay man. She lived in Atlanta. She understood about all this equality and stuff, and she got a lot of pushback. But one of the things that she was able to do was she made some interesting comments that were used in terms of this marriage equality issue as well. And I want to just read the quote, and then we'll close it. Mandy, where is that quote? Oh, in addition to the slave trade, blacks weren't allowed to marry either because the slaveholders said they're just not humane enough to understand. So we ended up having this tradition called jumping the broom. Does that sound familiar? Jumping the broom was one way in which you could, you know, still make that happen. So this is Coretta Scott King. I still hear people say that I should not be talking about the rights of lesbian and gay people, and I should stick to the issue of racial justice. But I hasten to remind them that Martin Luther King Jr. said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. I appeal to everyone who believes in Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream to make room at the table of brother and sisterhood for lesbian and gay people. Gays and lesbians stood up for civil rights in Montgomery, Selma, in Albany, Georgia, in St. Augustine, Florida, and many other campaigns of the civil rights movement. Many of these courageous men and women were fighting for my freedom at a time when they could find few voices for their own, and I salute them for their contributions. Enough said. Enough said. Thank you.
Thank you, Mandy. At this time, we'd like to invite anyone who has a question or comment or would like to enter a conversation. I saw a first hand here.
Mandy, thank you. I couldn't raise my hand when you gave those dates because I was born in 1945.
I should have said all those before. Thank you. All those before.
But I lived the same history that you lived. I was a freshman in college when I heard Dr. Martin Luther King, and you reminded me of this when Dr. Martin Luther King spoke to our college, and the quote that stuck in my mind and has been kind of a life changer for me was, "We cannot always change the hearts of people, but we can change their habits. And if we change their habits, their hearts may change."
Love that, Randy. Thank you. You know, Randy, that reminds me also. We met last night at Cherry Hour, and I said, I have never heard anyone doing Cherry Hour, but it was cool. I had apple juice. There was another great quote that came out of the Civil Rights Movement, was this interesting thing about, remember how we talked about how you change hearts and minds and public policy through law and Supreme Court, whatever? But there was a great quote said, you can't legislate people to like you. You can't pass laws to have people like you, but you can pass laws to have people stop lynching us.
Yeah.
We can pass laws to say we have a right to ride wherever we want to on a bus. We have a right, you know what I'm saying? And so I wonder sometimes when we get engaged in movements if we don't confuse sometimes people liking us as something confused with you got to get to what you need to get to understand, and sometimes people catch up with you. So that quote reminded me of that, and I think that was a great, powerful one. Other?
Did you have your hand up?
Every year when we bring out our rainbow flag, I'm reminded that the rainbow is also the banner of the deaf community. And I think that's, I was reminded that again when we went to the UCC conference on disabilities awareness. We had a representative from the national office of the UCC who represented the LGBT community. And I think this is something that we're seeing amongst all of us, is that the issues of justice, as you mentioned in your talk, the issues of justice are issues of justice for everyone.
Absolutely.
And we need especially to be speaking forth on these issues of justice for those who cannot speak for themselves.
Totally agree. In fact, I would say, I was thinking about you, Christina, if it hadn't been for the American Disability Rights Act and the way that was written, a lot of that language was used going into how we're going to be doing access legally for the LGBT community. So I think that when we talk about that, we need to, in fact, we need to revise our thing for song, and you put name all the isms that are in there just to really understand and make sure that we don't have people to try to come in and divide and conquer. I was just saying last night with the faculty thing at Duke, you have a lot of students there. And when I saw a woman and a person of color screaming at each other about who got there first and why, affirmative action, who was the largest set of people to be engaged in terms of affirmative action, because we needed it. It was women, white women, because that was just a numerical number. And I said, don't be yelling at each other. What you need to do is get in the same room and have a conversation about how we look at these issues of identity and ableism, name it, whatever, and don't get into divide and conquer. And people are trying to do that every single step of the way if they can get away with it. And yet we saw the coalitions that we just had in terms of not just the presidential. That's what made a difference. So I totally agree with you, Thomas, that there's got to be a way in which we define it. And also another thing, why do we always have to think about English as the language? Why is it spoken word? Why is it however we conceive to be just how things are done? The Estrella Foundation, it's a foundation, if you apply for a grant there, you don't have to write out on a piece of paper and all the little things or being a 501c3. They said, tell us however you need to find telling us. what you need, whether it's a picture, whether it's signing. You see what I'm saying? We just take this stuff for granted because that's just how it is. And the Highlander Center and other people are doing this. Everything they put out is in Spanish and in English. And depending on where you live, you might have to do all the different things of what the population is to have people hear, see, if you know what I'm saying, to make it accessible. It's pivotal, very important. Thank you.
Sarah, another person.
Hand behind you, Kathy.
Thank you so much for being with us here today. One of my questions/concerns is, as Christianity is increasingly becoming a globally South religion, and as sort of the brands or the kinds of Christianity that are populating the global South, Pentecostalism, Catholicism, and particularly sort of that have a more conservative theological approach, but also growing in areas where people are oppressed, particularly oppressed by economic policies that come out of first world nations. What sort of, it's a tenuous balance between sort of the way people have received Christianity from missionaries and how in their own way they've sort of understood the version or the way that Christianity came as oppressive, but still maintain a hold of the kinds of theologies that are, that continue to be oppressive in a different sort of set of ways. So can you speak to that a little bit?
I'll try. I had mentioned that when I was in Schenectady's Children's Home, they were pretty generic. If you're a Protestant, go to that church down the street. Half the time we didn't. We ended up hanging out in the whatever. But I really like the Quaker tradition and Unitarians because I bumped into them in terms of the work that I do. I'm not sure if I can answer your question exactly, but what I find interesting is this concept of colonization. Remember, they were called colonies. I had the good fortune to go to a World Council of Churches conference down in Zimbabwe, Africa. They do them every 7 years. And one of the workshops they did was, you don't have to bring a gun into Africa to get what you want. You bring that Bible in. I hope I'm not going to be stepping on any toes here. Africans who came here from all the different countries that made up this slave thing, whatever, church ain't, that's not us. That's not part of who we are. So yet that was, and yet that, whatever you might call the black church and whatever that was, that's a lot of where the work got done and a lot of the organizing and song and all that, and then you understand that that's part of the tradition. But to go to Zimbabwe, where it's literally rich, poor, and nothing in between. It was colonized by the British, and you got the French, and name me all the colonies. But part of it was the missionaries who were going into these countries, and I'm sure some of them had good reason. The other reason was we can get it done without having to do any violence, any guns and whatever, and this kind of don't question. And the highest rates of AIDS in Zimbabwe was staggering because they said, well, that's not something to come from us. That came from America. That's those white people bringing this stuff in. Are you kidding me? Staggering. And the price that has been paid around this, because the Bible said, in fact, I'm going to this, the Bible told me sell at 1 o'clock. So I only raise that because if that was something that was, and where do you get into the division of church and state? You know, and on the other hand, you think that people's faith, and I have to respect that, if that's the thing that holds you, binds you, that makes you feel like you're a part of who you are as a whole, and not getting to throwing out the baby with the bathwater. On the other hand, conversely, on the other hand, when you think about theology, whether it's whatever the denomination might be, and I'm thinking particularly within the African-American church, AME, that was like, that was their life. That's who they are. This is a part of who we are. But if it's not, it's like a thing, it's almost like the internet. You can use it for good or you can use it for however you decide to use it. And how do you steer however you might want to get there? And then there's a lot of people, I don't know what I am. I don't do it. I don't do church, so to speak. In fact, when I was here yesterday, that was the first time I said the Lord's Prayer since I was 8. You know, I mean, but I came. So I just wonder if there's a way in which one can be tolerant, one can be inclusive, one can be aware, but also all you know is all you know. All you know is all you know, whatever you have been born with, where you've been raised, what's around you, and I can't make any assumptions. And so I just wonder, as we move forward in terms of a really defined social justice movement, equality and justice for all, if that faith component has to be a part of it somehow, some way, and not have theology being used to beat over the head, because that's exactly what happened with the whole, you know, against slavery. And when we were trying to get slavery, you know, the church was used to try to go against slavery. The church was used against women. The church was used against people of color, you know, name me the list, and against LGBT. But yet faith communities within those also were the ones who probably had to be the ones who would be the other voices as well. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question correctly, but as I see it when I travel around, and I reluctantly came into this in terms of faith-based organizing as it's an issue within our community, when I heard people like the Christian Coalition and Focus on the Family and Concern Women for America and other groups that were using the Bible to find some ways to say, and you're not, and not you, and not you, and not you, right? And yet these were the same, like, Christian Coalition who had holdings in South Africa, for goodness sake, and had this racial reconciliation project that only lasted about 6 months because they finally, the black folks said, look, we might not get down with the gay thing, but you're the same folk who didn't want to give us rights either. So they had to let it go. People have long memories here. It's a complicated conversation, but I think it's important that we have it.